This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. When rice production was first established in the Carolinas, what we know now as North and South Carolina was a single colony. During the late 1600s, rice plantations started to proliferate along the Lowcountry. Associate Professor of History at East Carolina University Karen Ziff says approximately 500 to 1,000 acres total were dedicated to rice cultivation in North Carolina. That's compared to 70,000 acres in South Carolina.
There are mainly two reasons why South Carolina was a more friendly, I guess, state towards growing rice. One of those reasons is because it had a longer growing season. It requires just more, you have to have a longer period before the frost. And so the rice that was grown there was generally a slightly better quality, at least for market consumption.
A booming sugarcane industry in Barbados also played into the Carolinas' rice-growing interests. Sugarcane, which was produced on the Caribbean island, was so profitable for farmers that they didn't grow any crops to feed their slaves. Farmers began to set up rice-growing operations on the South Carolina coast, and the rice was sent back to Barbados.
So what happens then is that in eastern North Carolina, you see some of the growing conditions favorable to rice growing, and some of these South Carolina planter families begin moving up to the Cape Fear region. They find that lower Cape Fear River region is very suitable to growing rice.
Around the mid-1700s, Orton Plantation and Kendall Plantation were established in Brunswick County, North Carolina, to grow rice.
Those two plantations were owned by a man named Roger Moore, and he had about 250 slaves on those two plantations. There were quite a number of rice plantations in the area. Most of them were nowhere near as big as the rice plantations in South Carolina.
Readying a rice field was backbreaking work, tasked mainly to slaves.
It's very difficult to do because you had these swampy areas with, trees, some of them old growth trees that had to be cleared out. And of course, he brought in slaves to do this kind of really hard labor in terms of clearing land.
Before rice was planted, levees and dams had to be built so the cleared land could be flooded. At Orton Plantation and Kendall Plantation, fresh water from the Cape Fear River was manipulated to flow over the rice fields, submerging the plants for weeks at a time.
And then when the growing season needed to have more dry soil, they would dam up the river in order to allow the crops to continue to flourish.
Workers in the rice fields were exposed to dangerous and harsh conditions. They worked long days under the summer sun, trudging in swampy, snake and mosquito-infested water.
There was not any kind of mosquito control, so there was a lot of malaria in the area. It was not healthful work at all.
Zipf says planter families would give control to overseers and leave the plantation during the summer when malaria was more prevalent. Slaves from Africa already had experience growing rice, with male workers doing more hard labor and women working with the rice after the harvest.
They are the ones who are very instrumental in the techniques for separating the rice from the hull in order to make it consumable. And it requires a very deft hand in terms of utilizing what was a giant mortar and pestle in order to get these hulls off of the grain of rice without damaging the grain.
Even with the harshest conditions, expensive plantation maintenance, and human labor, rice cultivation was a lucrative business. Zipf says though growing rice in southeastern North Carolina was mostly for local consumption, some of it was exported to the British Empire. During the early to mid-1700s, a new industry began to emerge in eastern North Carolina that would eventually replace rice production. Naval stores, such as tar, pitch, and turpentine, came from the numerous pine trees in the region and was used as waterproofing for ships.
It was a more exciting industry because this was very lucrative in terms of keeping ships afloat.
It was during this time that three businessmen from Edenton set out to grow rice as a business venture. In 1785, the Somerset Plantation in Washington County was built. Assistant site manager Amber Satterthwaite.
6,000 acres were cleared and cultivated by slaves who dug over 50 miles of canals and 80 miles of ditches here. Now, one of the founders, Josiah Collins I, he eventually came to control the entire plantation. He renamed it Somerset Place, and wheat and corn would become the major crops here.
Between 1750 and 1850, rice cultivation in eastern North Carolina began to dwindle. The emancipation of slaves was the nail in the coffin for major rice production in our state. Even so, freed slaves and farmers continued to grow the crop, just on a much smaller scale. Local historical records indicate rice was grown by a man named Samuel Porter in Pamlico County. Heritage Museum and History Center historian Barbara Kerr says Potter was growing rice on his farm, located on the north end of Goose Creek Island, as late as the 1920s.
When he reaped his rice, he would beat it out, he put it in a cart, and then he took the cart to Fulford Point, and he would have a barge ready there waiting for the product, and then a schooner would come. And they would, from the barge, they would put the rice on the schooner and take it to Washington. And I'm quite certain they're talking about the original Washington, which is not very far away.
According to genealogical records, Kerr says another Pamlico County man named Colonel Jacobs also grew rice around the same time period, but very little is known about him. Now, in the 21st century, there are farmers still continuing the tradition of growing rice in North Carolina. Owner of Edible Earthscapes Farm in Moncur, North Carolina, Jason Otis, says he started harvesting his 1 acre of rice plants this week.
We're pulling it by hand. So we're basically meeting each grain of rice by hand and pulling it off into a bucket. And it does take a while to go through every paddy and, you know, meet every rice plant like this.
Otis has been growing rice in Chatham County for 6 years. He planned to plant a variety of rice that's been grown in the Carolinas for 200 years, called Carolina Gold, but instead opted for a grain imported from Asia.
We are growing a variety called Koshi Hikari, which is an old heirloom variety from Japan. It's a really special sushi rice.
The rice grown on Otis's farm is mainly used to feed his family, but some of it he sells to interested consumers in his area. Each May, his rice is planted and the fields flooded using water from a nearby pond. The rice remains submerged for about a week during germination. After that, Otis says it's up to nature.
We hope for a lot of rain in June is usually what we do. This year, we got less than an inch in June, so it was much less than ideal. Last year, we got, 10 inches or something in June, so we had a great rice year last year. This year is a little abbreviated, but the stuff that we did get in and we had enough water to start it grew really well, and it looks very nice.
Otis says he enjoys the challenge of growing the unpredictable crop. These days, the bulk of the rice America consumes comes from Arkansas, California, Louisiana, Texas, Missouri, and Mississippi. Farmers in these states produce more than 20 billion pounds of rice each year, according to the USA Rice Federation. While North Carolina doesn't contribute much to the commercial rice industry, it is important to remember the history of rice production here. A small schoolhouse for African American children in Currituck County reopened last weekend as a museum, showcasing photos of teachers and students, a teacher's desk and chalkboard, and a homemade bookcase that served as the library. Mac McKee speaks with Vice President of the historic Jarvisburg Colored School Association, Vivian Simpson, to get an idea on what life was like for students prior to desegregation.
Vivian, thank you so much for joining us today on the Down East Journal.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about this small schoolhouse, what its original name was, and when it was founded.
The original name of the historic Jarvisburg Colored School was the Powell's Point Free School of the Colored People. Mr. William Hunt, an African-American farmer, made a gift of land for the first school in 1868.
1868. So that
yes.
was just a few years after the American Civil War in 1865.
Yes.
Now, were there a lot of African Americans in that part of Currituck County in 1865?
Well, I'm not sure in 1865, but I have school records back in the 1800s that show that there were 12 public schools for colored children, with a total of 582 children beginning in the first grade.
This schoolhouse, of course, was built, as you said, in 1868 and has recently opened as a museum. How did this idea come about?
Back in 1970, members of Corinth Baptist Church met with a representative from the state of North Carolina they had shown some interest in restoring the building, which was very dilapidated. It was falling, and that's where it all began.
Now, what was a typical day like for maybe an early attendee that would learn early education, such as for these small children?
Lessons included reading, writing, arithmetic, and history, long walks to school in all types of weather. The students carried bag lunches containing leftovers from previous meals at home. They said that recess was always fun and that the end of a school day it meant a long walk back home.
How many miles would a child typically have to walk to get to the school?
Some of the stories I've heard tell of walks over 10 miles.
How many people attended the school at the time?
There could be anywhere from 50 to 90 kids in school. The maximum was 90 at any one time.
What was the main goal of opening this museum and turning this school into a museum?
The goal was to share with people, you know, all over the United States, some history about Currituck County and how children were educated here. Back in a time when it was not popular to educate black people. But Mr. Hunt saw a need for this, and he had a desire to make this happen. In fact, in the deed where he donated the land for the school, one of his comments was, "The donation of land was for the regard for and love I bear for the rising generation of the colored race."
Vivian, when did the museum first open?
On Saturday, September 27th.
And how was the response on that day? Have you had a lot of visitors?
Oh, wow. Approximately 130 visitors came through the museum on Saturday. All of their comments and reactions were very positive.
Now, what kind of obstacles did you face in, if any, in opening this museum? Was it a hard process?
There were all sorts of obstacles. Our region has experienced lots of storms and economic ups and downs. Even the planning stages was difficult, but it was something that we had a desire to do, so there was always a light at the end of the tunnel.
To open this museum, was it a mixture of public and private funding?
Currituck County allocated nearly $600,000 toward the completion of the restoration, and they've also set aside funds for final phase, a small support building which will house restrooms and a small office. The Historic Jarvisburg Coast School Organization raised nearly $100,000, which is going to go toward exhibits and operation of the museum.
Vivian, thank you so much for joining us today on Down East Journal.
Thank you for the opportunity to share some Currituck County history.
Tours of the museum are held by appointment only. They are free, but donations are accepted. For more information, go to www.historicjarvisburgcoloredschool.com.
I'm Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I'm seeing a lot of butterflies, moths, and their offspring caterpillars around the garden lately, and actually I had a really interesting experience with some monarch caterpillars the other day that really got me thinking. Most of us have heard about monarch butterflies and their dwindling populations. They do have this really beautiful mass migration where they migrate from North America down to Mexico in the fall. And it's just incredible to think about these little tiny butterflies flying thousands of miles to carry out their life cycle. And many gardeners are aware of butterflies and the threats to these butterflies and naturally want to protect them. Well, I was in the garden and I was checking out some butterfly weed that we've planted last year, and butterfly weed does not prefer to be transplanted, and we've been babying this butterfly weed. It had been thriving, it had bloomed well, and when I went to look at it the other day, it was just decimated. And when I looked a little bit more closely, I realized that it was covered with monarch butterfly caterpillars. I had really mixed emotions about this because monarch butterflies, which we value and treasure and want to attract and want to protect, had also killed the very plants that I was trying to grow due to their overfeeding. And it got me thinking about what constitutes a pest versus what constitutes a beautiful insect in the garden. We have a lot of butterflies and moths that utilize our gardens for their habitat. However, their offspring, the caterpillars, actually have very sturdy little chewing mouthparts and can be voracious consumers of plant material. So as I was thinking about these monarch caterpillars, I realized whether we consider a caterpillar to be the offspring of a beautiful butterfly or a pest to be destroyed in the garden has a lot to do with two things. And one is how beautiful and or endangered might the adult be, and what is it that this caterpillar is eating? And I thought the nutshell version is, if the adult is beautiful and the caterpillar is eating something that we don't value too much, then it's a butterfly. And if it's eating something that we value a whole lot, then it's probably a pest. What is and is not a pest in the garden is kind of complicated, but I would encourage gardeners to go out and look around their garden and see what sort of butterflies and moths are you seeing right now. Make sure you get good identification on them before you make a decision about what you're going to do. If you need to control caterpillars in the garden, there are several steps that you can take to help reduce your impact. You can tolerate them if the damage is slight. Many caterpillars can be hand-picked and dropped in a bucket of soapy water. Or products containing Bacillus thuringiensis can be safely used to control small caterpillars, but not large caterpillars. And row covers can protect particularly sensitive crops from damage.
Whether you're a master gardener or just developing your green thumb, you can help us cultivate the Garden Journal by sending us your ideas for future episodes. Just go to publicradioeast.org and click on the skybox on the right-hand side of the homepage. There, you'll be able to send us a message. Please include your name, where you're from, and your ideas for gardening topics you'd like discussed. The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Vidant Health. Introducing Vidant MyChart, providing patients a secure online portal to view personal information, connect with their healthcare team, request appointments, and more by way of computer, smartphone, or tablet. Learn more at VidantMyChart.com. The typical view of the path to musical success sends the enterprising young musician into one of our country's media centers, New York or L.A. For the members of Asheville's The Broadcast, they're taking a road less traveled in an effort to establish a musical career. George Olson spoke with the band's lead singer, Caitlin Crisco, and has this, which originally aired in November 2013.
I've long jokingly said that I'm still deciding what it is I want to be when I grow up. At 50 plus, the joke is getting old, as am I for that matter. Still, there's some truth behind the joke, which may be why I've always had a deep respect for anyone who determines what it is they want to be and pursue it doggedly with no doubt, no regrets. Among those now with my deep respect, Caitlin Crisco and her bandmates in the band The Broadcast.
And being in New York City, we realized, financially speaking, it really wasn't attainable to do that. We couldn't afford to pay our rent there and be on the road 150 days a year without, you know, spraining our back trying to get people to sublet our apartments and finding odd jobs in the city when we were actually in town. It was just really stressful to us. And then on a personal level, just growing up in New York, I had never really left home before after college, you know? And I just realized that I needed a new experience. And I think a lot of us realized we needed a new experience in order to be inspired creatively.
So the band packed up the van and moved to Asheville, with everyone moving into the same house so they could keep expenses down as they tried to follow a path they felt had been blazed by those who had musical success before them.
And so we started looking at the careers of bands that we loved. And when we were looking at the history of music, we noticed a pattern. And that pattern was, no matter what generation or decade it was, a lot of the greatest bands came from touring and literally sacrificing their lives to be able to tour full-time, bringing music similarly to a circus or a gypsy act. You go city to city, town to town, and you introduce your creative work to the people and hope that they respond to it.
And I know what it takes, and I mean this is true, and
There's an expression, how are you going to keep them on the farm once they've seen the bright lights of the big city? To some degree, Caitlin Crisco and the broadcast had the bright lights, opted for the farm. They chose to take the road traveled most, just in reverse. Caitlin also got some against-the-grain advice while receiving training at Circle in the Square, a respected New York theater art school, that prodded her to consider a different path.
I had always intended on pursuing musical theater in my life and had always planned on going the Broadway route. And I had a great music theory teacher in college, Marianne Ivan, who I'll always call out in interviews because she was such a pivotal moment for me. And she just planted a seed after my freshman year of college and said, you know, I think that you should be a rock star instead of a musical theater geek. And no one had ever told me that before. It was this aha moment that totally changed the direction of my life.
The rest of the members of the broadcast may have gotten similar advice in the past. In scanning biographies of the band's members, it seemed I came upon the word conservatory pretty regularly, to the point I half wondered if the broadcast was the revenge of the music room nerds. Caitlin didn't disagree.
With Michael Davis, our drummer, he was one of the star performer drummers at Manhattan School of Music. I mean, he's one of the best jazz drummers I've ever heard in my life. He's got a great side project, a trio called Enormous Trio, that is mind-boggling. And he's the go-to jazz drummer in Asheville now. And it's really funny that his passion project and his real focus is this rock and roll band that we've created. I think that there's just nothing quite like the energy that the broadcast shows bring to all of us. You know, we all do sort of side projects here and there just for fun, and we always come back to the broadcast because it's a workhorse. Hey, are you gonna waste it? Are you gonna go and throw this all away?
Virtuosity that might come from a conservatory education isn't immediately obvious in the broadcast new CD, Dodge the Arrow. It's well performed, but there's not a lot of what I've always termed give the drummer some moments, extended instrumental breaks that seem to say more about the performer's skill than its fit with the song. And that was the idea on Dodge the Arrow. Much as they emulated the road warrior-ness of bands they admired, they also wanted to model what they heard on their recordings.
And when we listened to records that we loved, and when we all started listing albums that meant a lot to us personally, they were pretty cut and dry records. You know, you listen to Led Zeppelin 4. I mean, it's a rock record, but there's not a whole lot of jamming. And if you listen to the Beatles, Abbey Road, or really any of the Beatles, there's really not a whole lot of jamming going on. And these records mean a lot to us, and we started to see a common thread. And we just didn't want to be long-winded with this record. I wanted to get to the point.
And they do. Dodge the Arrow is brevity defined. 8 songs running about 30 minutes. It's a paean to getting to the point and a realization of the times the broadcast is trying to survive in.
Let's be serious. People have very short attention spans now. And we can argue that, and we can say it's not true, and we can ignore it. Or we can embrace it and we can learn how to work with it. And we can learn how to get people's attention enough in a way where they don't suddenly start skipping songs in the record. You know what I mean? I wanted people to turn on Dodge the Arrow and on the last note of the last song, get upset about the fact that the record's over and want to turn it back on again.
Or better yet, go see a show. There's plenty of opportunity to do that. The band is constantly traveling, with Caitlin estimating since their move to Asheville in 2010, they average around 150 shows a year. The band is all in, from that commitment to touring whenever and wherever, to sharing living space, a decision Caitlin says has proven magical, and which she expects to reminisce on fondly in later years. They're all in another way as well. In the band's New York incarnation, they were Caitlin Crisco and the broadcast, Caitlin the headliner, the broadcast backing her up. Today, no more.
It was actually my suggestion to drop my name from the title. it was important to me to show unification. We're a family, and every single person in this band has sacrificed an enormous amount in their life to be able to pursue this as a career. And I thought that it was really important that each person was represented in the title of what we were setting out to do.
Again, All In. Dance the arrow as it's leaving from your bow. The new CD from Asheville's The Broadcast is entitled Dodge the Arrow. I'm George Olson.